We're talking with Timothy Green Beckley about Our Hollow Earth, the latest collaboration he's put together with his team of writers and investigators, looking at various theories about whether or not there are people living underground or civilization underground. There's one version of the theory that's been discussed over the years called the inverted Earth theory, the idea that you and I and the rest of humanity are actually in a civilization that's underground, and we exist in the interior of the Earth's crust, but we don't realize it. And that's pretty wild, pretty hard to swallow, but it is an idea that's floated around a long time, along with other variations. The idea that the hollow Earth has some sort of a sun or a source of light and heat down there that we haven't quite figured out yet. We're going to get into that in a moment with my guest, Tim Beckley, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're talking with Timothy Green Beckley about Our Hollow Earth, an inner world paradise or a gateway to hell. That's a new book that he and his team put together. In fact, they've got three new books that have come out in this series that explore some of these subjects in greater detail. Tim, you know, over the centuries, there have been all kinds of stories, some fictional, some maybe not fictional, about people or beings that live in the earth. Jules Verne, we mentioned already, in some of his versions, he's got like dinosaur type creatures down there. I remember H.G. Wells in The Time Machine, he wrote about the Morlocks who lived underground and they feasted on humans above. What's your take on it? Do you think there is something living down there? Because I don't have problems with the possibility that there would be, you know, there are giant holes in the ground that we've found. And you explore in this book all over the world, people looking for entrances into, if not hollow earth, then at least deep earth. Do you think there is something living down there that's other than us?
Well, you know, the weight of evidence would indicate that there is. In fact, I just spoke to a fellow today. His name is Maxim Shurk. He lives in Pennsylvania. And he's done incredible research on an incident that took place there in August of 1963 in Shepton, Pennsylvania. There were three miners that were trapped underground for, I think, almost a week. Two survived. One, the body was never found. There's some talk of cannibalism, but there's no evidence of that. And when they came to the surface, the two surviving miners said that they were kept alive by beings who came from inside the mine where they were trapped. The walls actually opened, and they could see lights inside, and these beings came out. And they also claimed that they had a vision of the Pope, who had just passed away at that point. I can't remember which Pope it was offhand. But in fact, the Catholic Church considers this a miracle. Now, there are many reports people encountering both the creatures underground. In fact, the miners in the West, they call them the Tommy Knockers. In fact, Stephen King did a book with the same title. And supposedly, the Tommy Knockers come and will replace the gold that the miners have discovered with fool's gold, and in some cases they will steal it altogether. Now, there were hundreds of cases in Ray Palmer's magazines. Readers were writing in to tell of incidents that happened to them, and there are quite a number of spelunkers, you know, cave explorers, who have come across remnants of what seemed to be lost civilizations. In fact, Eric Van Daniken, I think the second or third book that he wrote, he talked about a great discovery of a gold plates in, I believe it's Ecuador. And so these stories just continue to pop up. There was a story many, many years ago that was making the rounds that the remains of giant mummies were found inside a cave just on the outskirts of the Grand Canyon. Supposedly, they were sent to the Smithsonian Institute, but the Smithsonian Institute denies that to this very day. But the reports of this finding were printed in the newspapers around the, I think, the turn of the century or shortly disaster after.
Yeah, well, we had some stories that of that, something similar here in Nevada. I did a report on the red-headed giants of this. There's a cave in northern Nevada near Lovelock that the locals, the Native Americans, indigenous people say these giants were found mummified there, and it's hard to get solid answers on it, but those stories pop up all over the country, all over North America.
Well, one of the books in this trilogy that you talked about, it's Our Hollow Earth and Secret Exploits of Admiral Richard Byrd, and the third one is Alien Strongholds on Earth, and these are places that you can go and see UFOs, maybe not every night of the week, but they have, you know, a reputation for reports over a period of years. They'll pop up maybe for a couple of months, and then people won't see them for a while, and then they'll show up again. Mount Shasta is a location there in California where all sorts of strange things have taken place over a period of 150 years. I think going back to maybe 1870 or so, there was someone who was traveling on a train, and he was looking out the window, and he saw these mysterious lights over Mount Shasta, and there were people that have disappeared there. I had a fellow who was a Native American. He was a musician. He did some drumming with the Pink Floyd on one of their albums, and he was raised there on Mount Shasta, and he said they had all kinds of encounters with the dwarf-like beings that lived there. Some people claimed that they had seen, like, Bigfoot creatures. And there were even reports of this ascended master, Count Saint Germain, the man who lives forever, who wandered out of the city that supposedly exists under Mount Shasta, which is known as Telos. So this is one of the spots where all sorts of weird things have been transpiring, and of course it gets thousands of visitors every year who go there to meditate and to sky watch and to climb the mountain, which is a little bit too rigorous for me, but they have all sorts of adventures. Also, if you want to go to Sedona, Arizona, now I've heard all kinds of stories there about UFO crashes even, and there is a place called the Bradshaw Ranch. It's now owned by the government, strangely enough. But in its time, it was a haven for UFO reports. I mean, they have dozens of photographs that were taken there. These objects were coming onto the property, almost like Skinwalker Ranch.
Yeah, very similar.
Similar. In fact, they've had reports of creatures being seen around Sedona. One time, there was one that supposedly walked right across the main street of town. So
yeah, there's a lot of overlap between places where there's high UFO activity and legends about things that live underground.
Yes, there is.
Mount Shasta is a great example. The Andes, which you describe in the book, there's some really great photographs of people exploring these giant holes in the ground and tunnels in the Andes looking for the Hollow Earth.
Well, there was a fellow by the name of George Hunt Williamson who wrote under the pen name of Brother Philip, and he talked about a great monastery that was in the Andes, and they had the monks had hidden a gold bell inside one of the caverns there that eventually supposedly they'll bring out you know at some time in the future. But there are all these stories that pop up, and some of them, of course, are a little bit more documented than others. But there are all kinds of places that you can go and have these UFO experiences, and I call them alien strongholds. And a lot of them, even cases in the desert in South America, there's a fellow, very good researcher by the name of Scott Corrales, who's written for us for years. And he talks about all these cases that have taken place there where people have gone underground and seen all these cities and had all these bizarre experiences and so forth. So it's possible. I would tell people to be very careful. I mean, for example, you don't want to go exploring by yourself the area around the Superstition Mountains, because many people have disappeared there. Some people have just gone stark, raving mad. There have been a couple of murders in the area. People looking for the lost Dutchman mine who couldn't find it, that apparently got possessed. And there's even UFO abductions that have been reported there. I think a couple of people that supposedly got taken up and maybe never returned, or if they did return, their personalities and all had totally changed.
Well, let me lay you another idea on you. There's a guy named Dave Politis, a law enforcement guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's written all those books. The Missing 411 is one of our most popular guests. And
I know.
I think he's got a new movie out. One of the characteristics that he has described in all of his books is the idea that this connection with the ground and boulders, that these people disappear. And the assumption is maybe they're just snatched from the sky and taken somewhere. But it could just as easily be that they're scooped up by somebody else taking the other direction.
Well, I think this hasn't even had a couple of cases. I know that, let's see, Carla Turner talks about one where a child disappeared, maybe 3-4 years old, and was taken inside of a cave. And there was some, like, bear-like creature there that, they could just basically give an outline of the experience that they had because they were so young. But I think there have been a couple of cases where people have actually wandered back into civilization, usually very young children who have had experiences along that line. They've either been let go for some reason or maybe wandered out on their own, because there's certainly a lot of people that he describes that have never been seen again.
Help me understand this, the idea of hollow earth that has a sun inside. I don't get that. My brain can't process that.
Well, I believe that there could possibly be openings at the north and the south pole. The central sun, I'm not so sure about myself, but I haven't been down there, so I can't proclaim it as being real. But on the other hand, there are. I tend more to believe in the Shaver mystery and all these reports of cavern dwellers. I think they're a lot more realistic. There is supposedly a tunnel system that we talked about earlier that was constructed eons ago. I don't know, thousands and thousands of years ago, by these titans from outer space. And these tunnels exist throughout the planet. And from what we've heard, there's supposed to be like a vast system of trains that go from one area to another underground, which makes it easier for the people that live there, perhaps, to go from one place to another. One of the areas, again, that we've heard so much about, that doesn't seem to be very positive in its entirety, of course, is the UFO base that is said to exist underneath Dulce, New Mexico. I mean, there's a vast tunnel system there from what we've heard. Again, it's hard to prove it. But supposedly there have been actual fights with the Greys, who have taken over this base that has existed for thousands of years.
Yeah, I've heard those stories. There are some friends of mine who did a lot of research. They couldn't find it. They did find evidence from the Jicarilla Apaches and other local residents that there'd been a lot of weird stuff. Cattle mutilations, UFO sightings, poltergeist-type activities similar to Skinwalker, but they couldn't find any underground base or any good witnesses for it. So as you and your team go into these subjects and you sort of divvy it up, what is the process for, you're the editor who decides who covers what, and then you also decide what ends up in the book?
Yeah, pretty much. And I've been using the same team for quite a number of years. I've edited, 30 magazines over the years. A couple of them were UFO-oriented. The others were all different subjects. I once edited a magazine called Front Page Disasters and another one called Moped Action. Well, you can imagine how much action there is on a moped. that magazine lasted one issue. I'm glad it wasn't my money invested.
Well, that's a collector's item now. You could probably sell that on eBay.
If I could sell it on the eBay for $100, believe me, I would, yes. These are people that I've worked with and I trust, and they're valid researchers. Some of them have had first-person experiences, but most of them we rely on actual, you know, research and first-person interviews as much as possible, and historical data. You know, I was one of the top stringers for the Inquirer when, like, Bob Pratt and all worked there, and when it was a serious newspaper.
Yeah.
In fact, I won an award from them for being one of the top stringers that they had, and all the stories that we wrote were very well documented. In fact, they insisted upon having tapes, you know, like cassette tapes of all the interviews that we did. They verified everything with the celebrities and the and their agents and so forth. That's not to say that every once in a while something didn't slip through that wasn't kosher, but you could say the same about the New York Times, I'm sure, these days.
Well, Bob Pratt was a serious UFO guy.
Absolutely. Well, we did a book a couple of years ago called UFO Hostilities, and there is a large a section of material from his archives in there. That was the cases down in Brazil where people were actually being burned by these objects, and apparently blood was being sucked from their system. But we're not just talking about one or two individuals. We're talking about hundreds in this particular area.
Yeah, Kolaris, I think. Yeah.
Kolaris, yes, absolutely.
This guy, Shaver, Richard Shaver. So you begin the book talking about him, mm-hmm. but you're not beating around the bush about him. You make it clear that he has voices in his head.
Well, he admitted that. Now, I corresponded with Shaver for many years. He had a list of people. I guess he was on his mailing list. We didn't have any internet in those days, so of course. So we would make carbon copies, you know, like on onion skin the paper. I don't know if you remember that or not, but it was
sure.
A very thin paper. And if you loaded up your typewriter with seven carbons, you could make, you know, seven copies, and you pass them on to people, and they pass them on to other people. Of course, if you got the sixth or seventh copy down, your carbon would be very, very smudged. But he wrote some very interesting things, but a lot of it was totally off the wall. Now, he passed away, I think it was in 1975, around the same time that Ray Palmer did, actually, I think maybe a year apart. And he had gotten off the Dero kick to some degree and had gotten into promoting the concept that there was actually this ancient race of Titans that existed, and that they had left behind a whole series of, like, rocks. And if you cut the rocks apart, you could actually, they projected onto the rocks or somehow used the rocks as a photographs, just kind of like crystals are said to do. And he really pushed this idea, and of course, a lot of people thought, well, they couldn't see anything in the.
And he was sending you rocks, right?
Oh, he sent me rocks, and my mother would hate it. I was still a kid at the time. He would send a box of rocks he dug up from his backyard, and it would have gravel and worms in it. So but he was an interesting fellow. There's no doubt about it. And I think, yes, he was supposedly in a mental institution for a while. But, you know, now talk about Ray Palmer. Ray Palmer went to visit Shaver one time when he was living in Pennsylvania.
I'll tell you what, hold that story for a second. We need to go to a break again. We're talking with Timothy Green Beckley about his book, Our Hollow Earth, and we'll continue in just a moment. We're talking with Tim Beckley, who for a long time had the title Mr. UFO. So in a moment, we're going to open up the phone lines with your questions about our hollow earth topic. But I also want to touch base with Tim about current events. A lot of stuff going on in UFO land, and I want to get his take on it and see what he thinks. We'll be right back. So, Tim Beckley, I'm not quite sure how much credibility to give Shaver in light of, you know, what you've described with him mailing you a box of rocks. And but, you know, maybe he was dialed into something. You know, on occasion he'd get a beam of something that made sense into his head.
Well, you know, I was starting to tell the story about how Palmer was staying out at his house in Pennsylvania. And Shaver had gone to bed, and Palmer and his wife were in the other room, and they heard the voices.
They heard the voices.
They heard the voices. And Palmer was not, well, some people would say he was a crackpot, but he was a professional one if he was, you know what I'm saying? And no, I don't know. There was something about, I don't think that that many people would have followed Shaver and taken him seriously and reported similar experiences if he didn't have something going for him. Now, maybe he used the voices, kind of to cover up where he was getting information. Maybe it was coming from some other source. I don't know. But his stories were pretty darn wild. And Palmer, rewrote a lot of the stuff and made him even more far out. In fact, if you ever get a hold of some of those early Amazing Stories magazines with the articles by Shaver in it, some of them will keep you very busy for hours on hand, because most articles in those days, today we're used to reading, news articles that are like maybe a page long. Well, in those days, they were novelettes, 30 pages or longer.
Yeah, I'd love to get a hold of some of those. Before we go to the phones.
We've reprinted some of them, and we have a collection of Richard Shaver's material. I'll be happy to send you a copy of it.
Before we go to the phones, I wanted to mention about you reprint the Underground Travels, Niels Klim's originally published stuff. I guess it was, he sets it in Bergen in Norway, a town that I know well, mm-hmm. personal connection to that town. And I have to tell you, this came out long before Jules Verne. It reads like Jules Verne. I mean, this I don't know if Jules Verne saw this stuff, but it reads very much like what Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Well, I would agree with you, and of course he's considered somewhat of a folk hero in the town where he resided. They have statues and murals and stuff in the town square, so it's worth a read. Is any of the material on inner earth is, but Jules Verne, we got to give him credit. He popularized the subject. There's no doubt, about that. But there are other books. There's The Smoky God. There's a book called Etta Dorfa. There must be 20 some books that have been written with the concept of an inner earth or a hollow earth. Some of them purport to be based on real experiences. Others are science fiction or fantasy or whatever you want to call them, but they all seem to have a gem of truth to them.
Well, we'll take a couple of calls, and then I'll save some time to talk to you about current events in the UFO world. Wildcard Line, Paul in Boston. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. What an interesting program.
Thank you.
In keeping with the Hollow Earth theory, with opening both North and South Poles, 6 months ago, there was an item on TV. The Russian special soldiers are called Spetsnaz, and they were diving and by the North Pole. They had a sub and, of course, a tender with them, and they were deep diving, free diving, and they were set upon by what they described as a group of amphibians, which would be like frogmen. And when the Russian Spetsnaz went to get them, they were, a fight ensued, and some of the men were speared, and other men were burnt by what would be like a bang stick you would use on a shark. And they didn't collect all their bodies back, but the six or seven of them that made it up to the ice died mysteriously, some with the bends and some through other neurological problems. And that was it. They never said anything.
I'm trying to remember that story. I thought it might be Lake Baikal and maybe the deepest lake in the world where I heard that was where that occurred. Tim, are you familiar with that story?
Yeah, I hadn't heard that one, but I can come up with another incident here that goes back to around 1500. If I'm correct, it was off the coast of France where these UFO type objects hovered above the water, and there were amphibian type creatures or some kind of beings that were seen, and they shot cannons at them from the shoreline, trying to hit. I guess they thought the aliens were, whoever they were hostile. I don't know if there's any indication that they were, but I know that there was a painting. I think we used it in one of our books that shows this incident taking place between the French Navy and the supposed aliens, who I don't think shot back, but I don't remember the exact details of it, to be honest with you.
Paul, thanks for the call. Sorry I didn't have more information for you, but we appreciate you listening. East of the Rockies, Doug in New Jersey. Good morning, Doug.
Yes, thank you very much, and good evening, gentlemen. How are you both tonight?
Good, good.
Doing well.
Glad to hear it. My question was, I'm not quite sure what season it was. I've just seen it in repeats not too long ago in reruns on Ancient Aliens. They were talking to a gentleman who was a military, ex-military pilot. When he got out of service, he opened the bush plane service in Alaska, and he specialized in picking people up in very harsh conditions and areas that were hard to land and things like that, and making deliveries and whatnot. He had came forward and said that one spring he was checking out various fields and whatnot for landing conditions, and while crossing over a gorge of mountains, he looked down, and what he saw was two gorges opening up and then coming back together, as if it was, he said it appeared to him to look like a hangar door. And this was vertical in a gulch between two valleys in the Alaskan mountain range. And well, I wanted to know if you had heard anything about that.
Well, not that case in particular, but I have seen photographs from the, I think, the North Pole, or it could be the South Pole, I don't recall, but where it seems to show some sort of a door. And now, in fact, on this Ancient Aliens program of the other night, there was somebody on the program who claimed that they came across such a door, and when they pushed it with their finger, it opened into a great underground chamber that was illuminated, and there were all these ancient drawings or sketches or graphs on the wall.
Appreciate the call, Doug. We're going to try to get at least one more call in. West of the Rockies, Wayne in Tacoma. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Knapp, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And Mr. Beckley, I have a quick comment. The comment is about what is supposed to be the best UFO pictures ever taken. And that comes from the USS Trepang. In 1971,
yes,
submarine that took out of its periscope of a UFO. And I'm sure the audience would like to look at those online. Now, I'm interested in evidence, solid evidence, and you mentioned two libraries. One of the things that I came across in researching Admiral Byrd is that in his original expedition in 1927, he turned over 27,000 documents to Mr. Ford, who apparently paid for this expedition. Can you give us the names of the cities where those documents might be?
Well, I know one is at the University in Ohio. I believe it's Columbus, but don't hold me to it. If you Google it, two universities will show up. One is Ohio, and the other one is in Virginia. And the one in Ohio especially, they just have box after, I guess they put the material in cartons, just carton after carton after carton. I don't know, they must have 100 cartons of material by Byrd. I mean, somebody could spend an entire week there, and even if they didn't find any entrances to the hollow earth, they could probably find some really good material that has never been published before.
Really? So it's available to the public? You can go there and...
Yes, as far as I know, it is. Yeah, it's not a secret. Now, I can't say for sure that they haven't exacted? Is that the word? We're taking a material out that might be too sensitive, but maybe they don't even know what's in there. You know, take Cameron, the fellow there from Canada. You know, he's gone to all the presidential libraries and come across the stuff that they probably didn't even know you know existed. So yeah, this the one up in Ohio seems to have the bulk of the material, and I wish somebody would go and you know go over the files and see exactly what's in there. On the internet, you will find some brief descriptions, but nothing at any great length.
Wayne, if you end up going to the archives and digging through them, let us know what you find.
Oh, by all means.
All right. There's other people hanging on the phones, and we'll get to them in a second. I want to ask you current events, UFO stuff. Tim, I know you were Mr. UFO for a long time. I don't know how closely you follow all the various battles that go on. But recent events, the last 17, 18 months, have brought a whole bunch of new people into the field. They're interested in what's going on. It's being reported in mainstream media, New York Times, Fox News, yeah. Other places like that. And I think they're a little bit dismayed by how nasty things can get, especially with the prevalence of social media, how vicious the fighting gets. You've been around the topic a long time. Is it always this way?
Well, yes, to some degree. Now, I don't really follow. I kind of avoid social media. I mean, I'm on Facebook, and I do have my 5,000 friends, and once in a while I do have to let you know somebody go, because I not that I disagree with them so much, but the fact that they're obnoxious. But I don't know, I'm open to all, as long as you know a person presents themselves in a dignified fashion. Now, what did I, you know, I missed it tonight, but what did the president have to say about UFOs? Was he skeptical about it?
It was kind of a mixture. In 30 seconds, he had about four or five different answers. On one hand, he is skeptical about it, but he believes our pilots. He said he'd been briefed, but he doesn't really believe the larger picture. And then he said, hey, if more information comes available, he'll let us know. So that's good.
Yeah, well, I guess. Of course, Jimmy Carter had a UFO sighting, which they tried to push off as being the planet Venus, but most people don't realize this. I did a little bit of legwork, and down in the area where he had this sighting, there were other sightings before and after his the incident outside of the Lions Club. In fact, there was even an object that supposedly touched down, outside of town somewhere in a field. And none of this has ever gotten any attention. There was a filmmaker that was going to do a documentary on this, and I've seen the trailer that he did, but it's been pulled from YouTube, and I guess he never completed the movie, which is kind of a shame. And then, of course, the Clintons had an interest in the subject, and John Podesta, has continued to push it. That's one of the big disclosures from WikiLeaks. Was the correspondence that he had with Tom DeLonge. Big deal.
Yeah, I know. One of my emails was in there, too. It's a weird feeling to have. But
yeah, there you go. Exposed to the world.
let's try to get first-time caller Jamie in San Francisco. You're on with Tim Beckley.
Hey, Tim. How are you doing tonight?
Well, pretty good.
I really enjoyed your show, and I look forward to picking up your book. I wanted to ask you... a long time ago, about 15 years ago, there was an explorer named Steve Curry who was going to mount an expedition to the Arctic within a Russian icebreaker, and all these people were going to go, and they were going to go and explore the Hollow Earth. And mysteriously, he came down with inoperable brain cancer a few months before this whole thing, which that could be a whole conspiracy theory in itself, I suppose. But
yeah.
I want to know if you know if anybody ever, in other words, picked up the torch or planned on that, or do you think that's...
Well,
it's ever going to be a possibility that someone...
I hate to say this, but it's a pretty impossible task. I mean, I don't think an individual... He was going to, like, rent or lease an icebreaker or something like that. And the cost of doing something like that and going to the South Pole is astronomical. And I don't think he ever had enough people with enough cash to do it. I mean, you'd have to get somebody like a Bob Bigelow or somebody to finance something like that. It's just not going to be, you know, like a few dollars out of my pocket or your pocket or the listeners' pockets. You know, I mean, that takes some pretty heavy cash. That's why, you know, it's pretty much a military operation. I think at the South Pole there are now 6 or 7 countries that have bases there. Argentina would be one of them. And at the North Pole, maybe it's up to 9. And, of course, to some degree, I think there's always been a dispute over what area, land area belongs to who. And one would almost wonder, well, what exactly are they doing there? Why were the Nazis and all these other countries so persistent in wanting to establish bases there? I mean, I know that there are scientific purposes. You know, most people don't realize this, that the magnetic North and South Poles are actually different from the physical North and South Pole. And I suppose there's a lot of research or investigation that probably should go on as far as the poles go on a scientific basis. But they've always pretty much tried to use it for military purposes.
Yeah, I think that's probably the tensions are going to heighten there as resources get slim and competition for what's left heats up. The Russians, Americans, et cetera, in the Arctic anyway. Jamie, thank you for that call. Thanks to all the callers. Barry, my friend in South Carolina, sorry we didn't get to you. Tim, just to end, I enjoyed Our Hollow Earth. It's a fun read. I appreciate that you don't take it all that seriously and don't lock yourself into a position and stick to it.
I'm not, like I say, I'm not a scientist. I'm a journalist, and I've always thought I don't care whether it's Our Hollow Earth or something spookier or UFOs, that the information should be provided to the public, and they should have the opportunity to either accept or reject it. And I certainly hope that I hear from listeners who might have been in the military, who have something to add. They could always get in touch with me on Facebook or email me at MrUFO8@hotmail.com. That's MRUFO, the number 8@hotmail.com. And certainly you can find me all over the internet. Our YouTube channel is Mr. UFO Secret Files. We got over 400 interviews there. And, of course, I got a page and a blog up on Amazon.
Yeah, we've got a link to your website, conspiracyjournal.com. Is that the right one?
You do a great job of that with your guest, and it's much appreciated.
Tim Beckley, it's always fun to have you here. I hope you keep us in mind and let me know what you're up to.
You betcha.
All right. Thanks also. Thank you. Thanks also to Dr. Vince Houghton, our earlier guest, Nuking the Moon, and to my colleagues there at COAST, Michael Cosio. Gina Salvati is back with us, Greg Bishop, Dan Galani, Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next Sunday. Good night, everyone.